Chapter 2. The first of Nicholas Brady's paranormal experiences occurred at the house on Francisco Street, where he lived for years. He and his wife, Rachel, bought the house for $3,750 when they first got married in 1953. The house was very old, one of the original Berkeley farmhouses, on a lot only 30 feet wide, with no garage, on a mud sill, the only heat being from the oven in the kitchen. His monthly payments were $27.50. Which is why he stayed there so long. I used to ask Nicholas why he never painted or repaired the house. The roof leaked, and in wintertime, during the heavy rains, he and Rachel put out empty coffee cans to catch the water dripping everywhere. The house was an ugly, peeling yellow. "It would defeat the purpose of having such an inexpensive house," Nicholas explained. He still spent most of his money on records. Rachel took courses at the university in the political science department. I rarely found her home when I dropped by. Nicholas told me one time that his wife had a crush on a fellow student who headed the youth group of the Socialist Workers' Party just off campus. She resembled the other Berkeley girls I used to see. Jeans, glasses, long dark hair, assertive loud voice, continually discussing politics. This, of course, was during the McCarthy period. Berkeley was becoming extremely political. Nicholas had Wednesdays and Sundays off from work. On Wednesday, he was home alone. On Sunday, both he and Rachel were home. One Wednesday, this is not the paranormal experience, when Nicholas was home listening to Beethoven's Eighth Symphony on his Magnavox phonograph, two FBI agents dropped by.
"Is Mrs. Brady home?" they asked.
They wore business suits and carried bulging briefcases. Nicholas thought they were insurance salesmen.
"What do you want from her?"
he demanded with hostility. He imagined they were trying to sell her something. The two agents exchanged glances and then presented Nicholas with their identification. Nicholas was filled with rage and terror. He started telling the two FBI agents, in a stammering voice, a joke he had read in Talk of the Town and the New Yorker about two FBI agents who were checking up on a man, and while interviewing a neighbor, the neighbor had said the man listened to symphonies, and the agents asked suspiciously what language the symphonies were in. The two agents standing on Nicholas's front porch, on hearing his garbled version of the story, did not find it funny.
"That wasn't our office," one of them said.
"Why don't you talk to me?"
Nicholas demanded, protecting his wife. Again, the two FBI agents exchanged glances, nodded, and entered the house. Nicholas, in a state of terror, sat facing them, trying to quell his shaking.
"As you know," the agent with the greater double chin explained, "it is our job to protect the liberties of American citizens from totalitarian intrusion. We never investigate legitimate political parties such as the Democratic or Republican parties, which are bona fide political parties under American law."
He then began to talk about the Socialist Workers' Party, which he explained to Nicholas was not a legitimate political party, but a communist organization devoted to violent revolution at the expense of American liberties. Nicholas knew all that. He kept silent, however.
"And your wife,"
the other agent said,
"could be of use to us, since she belongs to the student corps of the SWP in reporting who attends their meetings and what is said there."
Both agents looked expectantly at Nicholas.
"I'll have to discuss this with Rachel," Nicholas said, "when she comes home."
"Are you engaged in political activity, Mr. Brady?"
the agent with the greater double chin asked him. He had a notebook before him and a fountain pen. The two agents had propped one of their briefcases between Nicholas and them. He saw a square object bulging within it and knew he was being taped.
"No,"
Nicholas said, truthfully. All he did was listen to exotic rare foreign vocal records, especially those of Tiana Lemnitz, Erna Berger, and Gerhard Husch.
"Would you like to be?"
the lesser agent asked.
Nicholas said. "You're familiar with the International People's Party," the greater agent said. "Have you ever considered attending meetings of it? They hold them about a block from here, on the other side of San Pablo Avenue."
"We could use someone in there at the local group meeting," the lesser agent said. "Are you interested?"
"We can finance you," his colleague added.
Nicholas blinked, gulped, and then gave the first speech of his life. The agents were not pleased, but they listened. Later on that day, after the agents had left, Rachel arrived home, loaded down with textbooks and looking cross.
"Guess who is here today looking for you?"
Nicholas said. He told her who.
Bastards! Rachel cried out. Bastards!
It was 2 nights later that Nicholas had his mystical experience. He and Rachel lay in bed asleep. Nicholas was on the left, nearer the door of their bedroom. Still disturbed by the recent visit of the FBI agents, he slept lightly, tossing a lot, having vague dreams of an unpleasant nature. Toward dawn, just when the first false white light was beginning to fill the room, he lay back on a nerve, awoke from the pain, and opened his eyes. A figure stood silently beside the bed, gazing down at him. The figure and Nicholas regarded each other. Nicholas grunted in amazement and sat up. At once Rachel awoke and began to scream.
Ich bin's,
Nicholas told her reassuringly. He had taken German in high school. What he meant to tell her was that the figure was himself, Ich bin's being the German idiom for that. However, in his excitement, he did not realize he was speaking a foreign language, albeit one Mrs. Alteca had taught him in the 12th grade. Rachel could not understand him. Nicholas began to pat her, but he kept on repeating himself in German. Rachel was confused and frightened. She kept on screaming. Meanwhile, the figure disappeared. Later on, when she was fully awake, Rachel was uncertain whether or not she had seen the figure or just reacted to his start of surprise. It had all been so sudden. It was myself, Nicholas said, standing beside the bed, gazing down at me. I recognized myself.
What was it doing there? Rachel said.
Guarding me, Nicholas said. He knew it. He could tell from having seen the expression on the figure's face, so there was nothing to be afraid of. He had the impression that the figure, himself, had come back from the future, perhaps from a point vastly far ahead, to make certain that he, his prior self, was doing okay at a critical time in his life. The impression was distinct and strong, and he could not rid himself of it. Going into the living room, he got his German dictionary and checked the idiom that he had used. Sure enough, it was correct. It meant, literally, I am it. He and Rachel sat together in the living room, drinking instant coffee in their pajamas.
I wish I was sure if I saw it, Rachel kept repeating. Something sure scared me. Did you hear me scream? I didn't know I could scream like that. I don't think I ever screamed like that before in my life. I wonder if the neighbors heard. I hope they don't call the police. I'll bet I woke them up. What time is it? It's getting light. It must be dawn.
I never had anything like that happen before in my life, Nicholas said. Boy, was I surprised, opening my eyes like I did and seeing it, me, standing there. What a shock. I wonder if anybody else ever had that happen to them.
Boy. We're so near the neighbors, Rachel said. I hope I didn't wake them.
The next day, Nicholas came around to my place to tell me about his mystical experience and get my opinion. He was not exactly candid about it, however. Initially, he told it to me not as a personal experience, but as a science fiction idea for a story. That was so if it sounded nutty, the onus wouldn't be on him.
I thought, he said, as a science fiction writer you could explain it. Was it time travel? Is there such a thing as time travel? Or maybe an alternate universe?
I told him it was himself from an alternate universe. The proof was that he recognized himself. Had it been a future self, he would not have recognized it, since it would have been altered from the features he saw in the mirror. No one could ever recognize his own future self. I had written about that in a story once. In the story, the man's future self came back to warn him, just as he, the protagonist, was about to do something foolish. The protagonist, not recognizing his future self, had killed it. I had yet to market the story, but my hopes were good. My agent, Scott Meredith, had sold everything else I had written.
"Can you use the idea?" Nicholas asked.
"No," I told him. "It's too ordinary."
"Ordinary?"
He looked upset. "It didn't seem ordinary to me that night. I think it had a message for me, and it was beaming the message at me telepathically, but I woke up and that ended the transmission." I explained to him that if you encountered yourself from an alternate universe, or from the future for that matter, you would hardly need to employ telepathy. That wasn't logical, since there would be no linguistic barrier. Telepathy was used when contact between members of different races, such as from other star systems, took place.
Oh,
Nicholas said, nodding.
It was benign?
I asked.
Sure it was. It was me. I'm benign. You know, Phil, in some ways my whole life is a waste.
What am I doing at my age working as a clerk in a record shop? Look at what you're doing. You're a full-time writer. Why the hell can't I do something like that? Something meaningful. I'm a clerk, the lowest of the low. And Rachel is going to be a full professor someday when she's through school. I should never have dropped out. I should have gotten my B.A. I said, "You sacrificed your academic career for a noble cause, your opposition to war." "I broke my gun. There was no cause. I was just inept the day we had to take apart our gun and put it back together. I lost the trigger down inside the works. That's all." I explained to him how his subconscious was wiser than his conscious mind, and how he ought to take credit for its vision, its sense of higher values. After all, it was part of him. "I'm not sure I believe that," Nicholas said. "I'm not sure what I believe anymore. Not since those two FBI agents came by and rousted me. They wanted me to spy on my wife. I think that's what they were really after. They get people to spy on each other like in 1984 and destroy the whole society. What does my life add up to, Phil, in comparison to yours, say? In comparison to anyone's? I'm going to Alaska. I was over the other day talking to the man at Southern Pacific. They have connections to Alaska through a yacht that goes up there 3 times a year. I could go on that. I think that's what myself from the future or an alternate universe was there to tell me the other night, that my life doesn't add up to anything and I better do something drastic. I probably was about to find out what I was supposed to do, only I wrecked it all by waking up and opening my eyes. Actually, it was Rachel who scared it off by screaming. That's when it left. If it wasn't for her, I'd know how to organize my future. Whereas it stands, I know nothing. I'm doing nothing. I have no hopes or prospects except checking in the goddamn Victor shipment that's up there at the shop waiting for me. 40 big cartons. The whole fall line they pushed on us, that even Herb went for, because of the 10% discount. He lapsed into gloomy silence. "What do the FBI agents look like?" I asked, never having seen one. Everybody in Berkeley was scared of just such a visit as Nicholas had received, myself included. It was the times. "They have fat red necks and double chins, and little eyes like two coals stuck into dough, and they watch you all the time. They never take their eyes off you. They had faint but detectable southern accents. They said they'd be back to talk to both of us. They'll probably be by to talk to you, too, about your writing. Are your stories left-wing?" I asked. "Haven't you read them?" "I don't read science fiction," Nicholas said. "I just read serious writers like Proust and Joyce and Kafka. When science fiction has something serious to say, I'll read it." He began then to talk up the virtues of Finnegan's Wake, in particular the final part, which he compared to the final part of Ulysses. It was his belief that no one but himself had either read it or understood it. "Science fiction is the literature of the future," I told him when he paused. "In a few decades, they'll be visiting the moon." "Oh, no," Nicholas said vigorously. "They'll never visit the moon. You're living in a fantasy world." "Is that what your future self told you?" I said. "Or yourself from another universe, whatever it was?" It seemed to me that it was Nicholas who was living in a fantasy world, working in the record store as a clerk, meanwhile always lost in great literature of a sort divorced from his own reality. He had read so much James Joyce that Dublin was more real to him than Berkeley. And yet even to me Berkeley was not quite real, but lost, as Nicholas was, in fantasy. All of Berkeley dreamed a political dream separate from the rest of America, a dream soon to be crushed, as reaction flowed deeper and deeper and spread out wider. A person like Nicholas Brady could never go to Alaska. He was a product of Berkeley, and could only survive in the radical student milieu of Berkeley. What did he know of the rest of the United States? I had driven across the country. I had visited Kansas and Utah and Kentucky, and I knew the isolation of the Berkeley radicals. They might affect America a little with their views, but in the long run it would be solid conservative America, the Midwest, which would win out. And when Berkeley fell, Nicholas Brady would fall with it. Of course, this was a long time ago, before President Kennedy was assassinated, before President Ferris Fremont and the New American Way, before the darkness closed over us completely.